G'day and welcome back to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour, and this week's episode is entitled End of Eras. T-Swift's new big hit motion picture on her Eras tour. We are going to be talking non-stop 30 minutes Taylor Swift movie content. No, of course not. We'll not be talking about that motion picture that was in the bunny ears there on this show. I mean, maybe we will. Email in if you want us to talk about the Taylor Swift Eras movie on Sacred Cinema here on 2XX98.3. My email is contact@jimmybernasconi.com. No, we're talking about films that depict people or relationships or even broader political entities coming to their end, or we've got a motif of falling this week, going down, descending, things when they go into a downward spiral. And we've talked about things like downward spirals and radical shifts and change in culture and things like that on a lot of the show, but we've never talked about films that are related by having this common motif of everything going down for the protagonist. Or the protagonists. The films we're going to talk about, first one is going to be Joel Schumacher's 1993 film Falling Down, starring Michael Douglas and Robert Duvall. We're then going to move on to a new film, one of the big ones of the year, Justin Treat's new film Anatomy of a Fall, very highly anticipated film this year. And then we're going to finish off with Bernardo Bertolucci's. I've got to stop doing accents when I do a European director, but I am Italian, so that one's not that one's okay, I think. But Bernardo Bertolucci's 1987 film The Last Emperor. And I think, you know, usually we do a bit of an intro at the start of the episode to sort of touch base on everything and like what we're going to be talking about in terms of broader themes, but it's a pretty bulky one this week. I'd like to get straight into it, and I think we'll sort of sift through things as we go along. So let's get started now with Joel Schumacher's 1993, I guess you've got a dark comedy, Falling Down. So I actually hadn't seen this film till this week. It's been hyped up for me. There's a lot of talk about it on the internet. It's getting a bit of like a cult classic identity at the moment. I think it's one of those films that kind of has like a, I'm going to use this word a couple times this week, unfortunately, a sort of Kafka-esque quality to it. It's giving it this resurgence. I think it's maybe put it in the same basket. A film historian may not do this, or maybe like a high industry elite might not do this, but perhaps a film historian would put it maybe in the same category as a film like After Hours, which came out a few years before, and Scorsese's masterpiece After Hours, which we have chatted about this week, on the show. But if you don't know about it, it's about this guy, and his name is D. Fenz. Then we only know him from his number plate and his car, and that the opening scene of this film is miraculous. Like, it's a fantastic opening scene to a film. It's almost worth watching if you haven't seen it before, just for the opening scene. Michael Douglas is almost like a guy from Office Space, that movie with Robin Livingston. He's got the sort of the short sleeve white shirt with the pens in the pockets, and he's, you know, nerdy glasses and the crew cut, and he's sitting in traffic. And all we know about this guy in terms of his identity for the whole film is that his number plate is D. Fenz. And then we find out that he works sort of in defense and that sort of thing, but there's obviously a bit of a metaphorical quality to his name being D. Fenz. And essentially he just cracks it one morning in the heat of Los Angeles. And I should say, as someone that's traveled to Los Angeles a couple of times, this was a great depiction of what it's like to be in Los Angeles as someone that isn't familiar with the area and is a little bit scared of how kind of grotty and grungy it is. I think a lot of films glamorize Los Angeles, like the Hollywood spark. Like this definitely captures the heat, like just in the terms of the cinematography and the lighting, it definitely captures that very orangey, warm heat. And maybe a film like Sean Baker's Tangerine probably does a little bit, maybe a little bit less tropical as a Paul Thomas Anderson film. This almost borders on like the Denis Villeneuve Blade Runner scene when he goes to the orange desert. That was kind of like similar to when Sydney had that sand. So like, it's a very orange looking film, and so you're very, very sweaty watching it. Are you feeling under the pump when he puts a can of Coke to his face at one point in the film? You're like, oh man, that would feel so good, which compounds how tense everything is, with everybody yapping around and screaming and squawking and begging him for money throughout the whole film. It's essentially a film about a guy who just has had enough of the hustle and bustle of Los Angeles on a hot summer's day, and basically just decides that anyone that annoys him and rubs him the wrong way through some kind of act of selfishness or self-indulgence or overly bureaucratic or administrative power move, he's just going to like rock their sh, basically. And I want to talk about it in the context of today's discussion about, you know, the idea of going down, falling down, the end of, you know, this is the film we're going to talk about that sort of talks about falling down on a personal level in terms of the end of his era as a law-abiding citizen, let's say. I want to talk about this sort of how it depicts this idea of how the encroachment or the imposition of monolithic systems can lead to this very, I want to emphasize sort of the suddenness, the immediate or dramatic demise of the individual, just sort of an instantaneous moment of just going, you know what, I was a normal functioning white collar guy, and now I'm a full blown terrorist level criminal, almost at the drop of a hat. And so his character, I think part of the reason why this film probably didn't do so well when it first came out is that he's a very hard character to box in. I think he's a very well written character, although I think the film kind of has this aura of being kind of like an action comedy from the 90s. You might think that this would come on after the footy on a Friday night, and you know, this is just a fun sort of throwout round film. I think that the character, unfortunately, is probably more complicated than what the film kind of projects in its aura, because he's sort of that really kind of beautiful neither hero nor villain kind of character. I wouldn't call him like a tragic hero. Like, he does some pretty bad and violent things. We get a pretty clear depiction that he's a pretty sick guy and he's a pretty crazy guy, but we also completely empathize with his experience sitting there in the traffic and feeling like the world is suffocating him, and that his sovereignty as an individual, his liberation, his emancipation as an individual is certainly threatened by this monolithic system that's sucking him of his energy. So he's this kind of what I consider sort of this complex abomination that is the result of pretty much a great deal of energy and purpose being suffocated. Like that can't get out of him essentially by this Kafkaesque maze of particularly rules and regulations, feeling like there's no sense of peace and quiet for him to enjoy in his, you know, home, in his community. And I think this is a little bit ahead of its time in terms of how it depicts up how quickly someone can snap and go crazy like this. I mean, it is quite derivative of, say, like a film like Taxi Driver, where you have this kind of vigilante moment where a guy just goes, oh man, I just need something to fight for. And, you know, speaking about that out loud, I guess Fight Club comes out of this similar era. But if we think about kind of the 2000s, remember this film comes out in 93, so in the decades that follow we get this, and I'm not saying that sort of gun problems in America haven't been a problem for a long time, but the idea of sort of the lone wolf is certainly something that I remember being something that really came to the fore, particularly in the 2000s, but all through a lot of those terrorist attacks of the 2010s. And you know, obviously post 9/11 it became a very big thing. It was really probably the main moment that it happened. But I think this is a really unique film in how it shows the sort of the sudden drop of a hatness of that kind of transition into becoming radicalized, and how it doesn't necessarily have a religious quality to it. It's simply just any kind of monolithic systemic suffocation can be enough to turn someone into a crazy person. I think the film actually does a really mature job of actually, even though he is a pretty bad guy, juxtaposing him against like an ideological terrorist. So there is a scene where he deals with this neo-Nazi chap and he distinguishes himself from him and he refers to himself as an American. It's kind of a patriotic scene for him. So we find this, and this is what I mean, I think that the character is almost too complex for its own good, because for his own good, or for the film's own good, because he kind of slides very into a very specific crack, which is someone that's simply just revolting against the system itself, not for the sake of some kind of religious or spiritual or political radical ideology, revolting for almost like a rebel without a cause kind of situation, but seriously rebelling, not just being angry and going and getting arrested by the police after the prom, like causing serious trouble. But what's really, I think what we really need to touch on in talking about this film is the juxtaposition between Douglas's character and Duvall's character, who is the cop that's following him the whole day. And what's really important, especially in the context of today's episode, talking about the end of an era, What's central to Duvall's character, his name is Prendergast, is that he's on his last day. It's a film that takes place on one day, and it's his last day as a cop. And so his story is interesting. It's the story of a man who's about to end a very kind of admirable chapter in his life, a very long and admirable chapter as a policeman, kind of a heroic chapter. And it's interesting that throughout the film, there is this motif of his wife and his co-workers and his boss, and there's a going away party. It's kind of every element of his life is telling him to quit, to go home early, to give up the badge now, go home and relax and go off to Arizona where he's going to retire. But in his heart, he knows, which is in complete juxtaposition to Douglas's character, no, I have to endure. I have to stay in this. I have to make right what is wrong. I need to fix this. I can't quit now. I need to keep going. And of course, you know, Michael Douglas has given up. He is revolting. He's had enough. He's not putting up with the system anymore. He's not maintaining anything. He's going to knock things down. So it leaves us in a funny place because it kind of reminds us that the human spirit is both capable of tragically falling very dramatically, very suddenly, very immediately into this state of essentially a state of radical kind of terroristic revolt. But at the same time, in the Duvall character, we've also got this capacity to endure, to be persistent, to stay loyal, to maintain our virtues, to not crack it, to remain to be a respectable person, even if the rest of the world, even if the entire world is telling you, no, you've done your job, you're allowed to stop. And we see that as very admirable. It's something in us that reminds us that's admirable. So if we know we're capable of both those things, we know that we value not falling into a pit of despair, surely we know we can see the signs of that. Surely that we can nip that in the bud when we see it. Well, before we talk about our next film that addresses that question, just remind you, I listen to Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Power Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi. And we'd really appreciate it if you could stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX, and also consider jumping onto our website. Fall into our website to subscribe to the station or sponsor the show. Would very much appreciate that. But let's move on now to a big film for the year, Anatomy of a Fall, directed by Justine Treat. I'm pretty sure this is the Palme d'Or winning film at Cannes this year. The long and short of it is essentially like a crime drama set in France, I think it's like the French Alps, some snowy part of France. And essentially at the beginning of the film, there's a dead guy on the floor in the front yard of this house. After his son comes home from a walk and his wife standing there being like, your father's dead. And then the whole film is a question of, it's a quite a long film, despite having only like 4 or 5 main characters. What happened to this guy? Did she push him? Did he commit suicide? What was going on? And in the context of talking about ends of eras, I want to talk about this. Falling Down is kind of the end of the era of an individual. This is sort of the end of an era of a relationship, an interpersonal chapter ending. And I want to talk about it and how it explores this idea of our inability to perfectly dissect a moment of downfall, to perfectly dissect a tragedy. Because there is an impetus to do it, obviously. When something terrible happens, when someone falls from the top of a building, we want to know what happened. And I think if it's not clear to you already as well, Anatomy of a Fall, it's in the title. It's not just, you know, a question about, you know, how did this single guy die? But in it being Anatomy of a Fall, it really is a question about relationships. And it's almost like an autopsy of this couple's relationship. It's the fall of the husband is symbolic of the downward trajectory of their relationship. And as the film progresses, you see sort of how, when, you know, whether she did it or not, their relationship was going in a downward direction. So we're going to cushion this conversation about this film sort of more so in their relationship spiraling down and considering the death being more symbolic of that. Now, I think there's two aspects of this film I want to talk about in how it depicts this idea of our inability to dissect this tragedy and fully understand why it failed, right? There's always this inherent danger that we could all fall, that our relationships could all fall apart. We want to know why that might happen. Well, I think this film kind of gives us two hints why we might not be able to find out why that happens. The first is that it's like the more that we dissect something, the deeper we go into something, the more complex it becomes, the more little aspects, the more little nooks and crannies, the more nuances we find in it. So films that come to mind that this film, I think, very much builds upon are things like Synecdoche, New York, which we've talked about on the show, and also David Fincher's Gone Girl, which I think is very much a film for the 21st century in the digital age, which is the more that we look into something, the more that we realize that it's not a simple black and white story. The more it is that, the reason, if someone ever does something crazy, it's probably because something crazy happened to them. And isn't that something that we've been talking about a lot in the news recently about, why is this person doing this thing that seems tragic and crazy? Well, before that, actually something else, like what happened to them? Well, something before them happened to them, something before that. And I think this is a film, a really good depiction of how, and just as a social experiment or experiment on yourself, how quickly your biases get found out in this film. And I think it is film at its best when you, I mean, I loved this film. It's film at its best where you realize that you do have very immediate biases and you fall into a certain pattern very easily and you become so sympathetic towards a certain person's puppy dog face to then find out that actually it's something hectic and crazy 5 minutes later, but then you flip back again when you find out why they did that crazy thing. So I think it's very much a good film for our time that follows, it follows in the same footsteps as some great films that came before it. But I want to particularly focus on how the film explores this idea of accountability or liability being in opposition to truth, right? If we want to find out who did something bad, this seems very obvious, but the film, I think, does a really good job of explaining sort of the depth of this issue, is that if something bad happens, obviously the person that did it, in the way that we view personhood and people and guilt and liability and accountability, no one is going to admit that they did it if they did do it. And so it makes it very difficult to understand who is responsible for an act if we know that lying and dishonesty are kind of par for the course. That's in everybody's arsenal type thing. And I know that's a really sort of trite thing to say, but let's go into it a little bit. So if you think about sort of like a crime, and someone's a suspect of a crime, they know if they did it. They know if they didn't do it, and they know if they did do it, but then they're not going to tell if they did do it if they want to get away with it, right? But I want to go the next step further. What if people kind of know what they did, kind of know what the other person did, but also it's really hard to explain why and how they did it and the nuances of, well, yeah, I may have done that, but you've got to really understand it's not the way you think about it. That terrible thing that usually sounds bad on paper, I did technically do that, but it's not in the same way you think. And I think this film has this really interesting motif of communication. Both of the main characters are writers, and there's a constant conversation about kind of, there's a sense of competitiveness around who the better writer is. And there's also an interesting motif around language as well, where the wife is German and the husband is French, but they speak to each other in English. And there's actually literal conversation around sort of the rules around that and how that's fair or unfair in terms of, who's more native to that language. And I think that's a really sort of perfect metaphor for what it's like to be in a relationship where you are kind of speaking, or in any kind of dynamic where there could be a potential dispute, one person speaking one language and someone speaking another and not being able to bridge those gaps. And so things remain sort of incommunicable, if that makes sense. And of course, this sort of compounds all of the surrounding relationship stress. And it can mean that you kind of end up being married kind of to a clam. And so you've got this person sitting across from you that kind of knows the truth. They know why they feel a certain way. They know why they hate you in that moment, or they know why they love you to a scary degree, but they can't explain it because you're two separate people speaking different languages. And you're in the sort of state of, who is the better communicator? Can you speak in both my literal language and in my own emotional, or as what people call their own love language kind of thing? And so the result of this is we find ourselves in so many countless fishy situations where we don't really know the clear reasons why something happened, and we just have to sort of live the rest of our lives knowing that we don't really understand why certain things happened. And there's no shortage of historic examples, like something as simple as, the assassination of JFK. It's so riddled with mystery, and we sort of move on and accept that we don't really understand what actually happened there, because we kind of accept that we can't speak the language of government, government can't speak the language of us. But before we get too deep into the systemic sort of side of things, let's actually move on to our next film, because we're at this point now where we accept that there's sort of this risk of sort of like a sudden fall that could be very dangerous for individuals, but we also understand that it's very hard to get to the core, to get to the source of that. When someone does come into a, fall into a tragic situation, or someone is even the perpetrator of bringing about a tragic situation, it'd be very hard to get to the bottom of that for many, many layers of reasons. So let's move on now to a very big film, Bertolucci's 1987 film, The Last Emperor, to sort of look at this on the more systemic political level and see if we can sort of maybe find some answers to some of these questions here. So this is one that essentially follows, the biopic that essentially follows the life of the last Chinese emperor, Pu Yi. We start him as a little boy, and then we sort of track through his life. And if you haven't seen the film, I don't want to give too much away because it's an incredible film. And I want to talk about how, firstly, it reinforces this idea about the suddenness of change and kind of the, how profound change can be in such a short period of time. Because, you know, we do give ourselves this illusion that things are here to stay in a big way, and that the systems we find ourselves in are sort of classic natural systems. But this film really does remind us that history is this story of buried errors, that there are so many errors that have come and gone that we are not aware of, and they were around not that long ago, and the current era is going to disappear, and the people that come after us are going to forget that we existed, and the way that we lived was the way that we lived, and it's going to seem so alien to the rest of us that are still around, to look back and, like, you know, you understand why old people are constantly telling you about their what it was like when they grew up, because it was very different, or at least in terms of appearances. We're going to get onto that in a second. So radical change is kind of always waiting in the curtains in a way. And we see in this film on the personal level for Pu Yi, we see this very profound personal downfall where he starts off as the divine emperor of the biggest country in the world, and to then become this very humble just citizen of this country that literally just works and lives on the streets and no one knows who he is. But then we're also seeing on the broader political level, you know, the film is called The Last Emperor. It's not just that he's the last emperor of China. He's the last emperor in a history of, you know, after the age of empires, which I'm not sure if that's exactly true because there's some questions around whether a czar is an emperor. But essentially, when we think about empires and emperors, Pu Yi kind of was like the last emperor, capital E emperor of human history in a way. So it sort of implies that, which is very representative of this broader story, that implies that the world has these huge radical changes in such a short period of time. We kind of lose the vocabulary of how we were, how we used to govern ourselves. You take something like a current issue, like the Israel-Palestine situation. We kind of understand this conflict as, like, if we look at it in the news, it's this conflict of competing nationalities. But I have to say that this is kind of ignorant of the fact that part of this affair generated from the fall of the Ottoman Empire, and then again, what you might call the fumbling of the British Empire after the First World War. I mean, the First World War took place when there was still, you know, a Russian Empire, an Ottoman Empire, like we were using different types of international actors, different rules, different concepts of international relations, and now this conflict is sort of become all the more complicated because of that, because we're using old rules and the vestiges of old international rules of international relations, the vestiges of old concepts that have now become extinct. Are kind of riddling and sort of littered throughout this issue. And when you watch a film like this, you're reminded that it wasn't that long ago that the structure of politics and international morality and ethics was completely different. We had a Hobbesian view of the world. We didn't employ morality when we thought about how countries interact with each other. It was a history of war. It was a history of ending eras. But having said all that, how big are these changes really? Because I think this film does a brilliant job of depicting how change and conservation, or progress and conservation, or I think change is a better word than progress in this context, can mask as one another, right? Or can mask one another and masquerade as one another. So what I mean by that is the appearance, we can have the appearance of things changing before our very eyes, but it is just an appearance. And what can very often happen is that we're really just reinstating the very same problems that we are trying to replace. This is very reminiscent of what we talked about a couple of weeks ago, particularly when we talked about the film Akira, but Manchurian Candidate, and the idea of heroes from the past being villains of the present and villains of the past being heroes of the present. And this idea that solutions can be given sort of at the, or supposed solutions or attempted solutions can be given at the cost of the few things that we actually valued from the past, where we try something to think that it'll fix things, but all that it's doing is erratic, it's throwing the baby out of the bathwater. We're getting rid of the at least those few things that we thought we had just to bring about change for the sake of it. And all that's doing is reinstating a lot of those same problems from before. And there's no shortage of examples in history of that. Just thinking about, at least in the 20th century, how you have sort of radical right-wing ideologies and radical left-wing ideologies being huge responses to one another, but kind of leading to the same totalitarian, authoritarian states. And speaking of which, we do have these motifs of imprisonment and power, or imprisonment and emancipation, colliding with one another in this film. So through the first sequence of the film, Puyi is this emperor. He's the most powerful man in the country, but he's also imprisoned within the Forbidden City. So there's a natural juxtaposition there. And then by the end of the film, he's finally free to roam everywhere, pretty much but the Forbidden City. And obviously, if you've seen the film, the rope is very symbolic of, you know, what he is and isn't allowed to do, which is in complete contrast to what he was and wasn't allowed to do it when he was at the start of his life. But he's lost all his power at this point. So it's like he's gained all of the things he used to have, but at the cost of everything that he gains the things that he used to not have at the cost of things of all the things that he did have. And it's a question of not freedom versus imprisonment, but what bits of what pot do you want? How much from each pot do you want? And, you know, you're going to have to take a kind of 50-50 of one or the other in terms of a ratio. But, you know, how much freedom, or what kind of freedom do you want, and what kind of imprisonment do you not? Not do you want more or less of one or the other kind of thing? But I think it's worth sort of going back and looking at all three of the films together now. So we talked about falling down. We talked about this idea that when we have an individual that's in a state of free fall, it can be very dangerous. But that's not to say that we're all necessarily destined to a point of spiraling into a state of personal chaos. We are capable of enduring. And so it's worth trying to dissect why one person might fall and one person might sort of maintain their strength. But when we talked about anatomy of a fall, we did try to dissect why that happens, at least on the interpersonal level. It can be so hard to understand why and who is responsible when a downward spiral takes place. In fact, the deeper we look, sometimes the more complicated it gets. And that can be because of the people that know how all the answers are obfuscating things as much as they possibly can to avoid accountability. And so ultimately, what we need to be very careful of when we do try and understand why things fall apart is to be very careful of old problems ushering themselves in, Trojan horsing themselves in, masquerading as new solutions. Something putting its hand up to say, like, I'm the solution to all your problems, but really just being a more powerful and more scary version of the very thing we're trying to avoid. For it is kind of, I think it's entirely possible for superficially monumental changes to show their face and to occur in the real world, for us to only realize that we're reinstating these very, like something that's very new and novel, but really ultimately just a stronger version of the very problems that we tried to solve in ending the previous era. That's all we've got time for this week on Sacred Cinema here on 2XX98.3 FM People Powered Radio. Thank you so much for joining us this week, and please join us again next week on 2XX for more Sacred Cinema action. Also stay tuned to 2XX right now for more quality radio programming here, and also jump onto our website to listen there or subscribe to the station or sponsor our shows. All of that would be very much appreciated. But we'll see you again next Sunday, and hope you have a very good week. Cheers.